Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. For the present, my answers are posted every other week on Mondays, and Dr. Yaron Brook answers questions on current events on the alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off at the end, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter.
Seven steps in writing in order. These are the seven things I do in this order. After I give you the seven, I'm going to spend the rest of the whole period on one. Now, this presupposes this list. You already have an idea. You have a topic that you want to put down. If you don't have that, there's no way of discussing how to write it. You have to have the content. Not every word, every connection, or even every sub-point, but what is your main point that you want and your idea of what kind of art? Now, given that, step one, I said this is mine. Maybe other people don't use it, but it certainly helps me. Step one is the laundry list. Very important. Now, I'll tell you what that is later when we get to it, because I want to spend today on it. You're going to end up with a list of topics. Step two, discard or add to that list according to your idea of what you want to say. Now, if you do this the next day, if looking at this the next day, and you always look, you know, from another person's perspective, you always think, why did he include that? Or she include that? Never I. You get some objectivity. If you look at any topic that way and say, is this really relevant? Is this something that's really necessary to my talk? Now, you may find, well, this is interesting. I know why it occurred to me, but given the, you know, the audience and the time and everything, I don't need this point. Cut it out right there. Or you're looking and you say, yeah, I put this point in, but it's not going to be clear. Unless I really expand it, I should really add this and this. So let's say we add this. In other words, you juggle it because the first is completely unbiased. You just slop it out. Then the second, you get rid of it as much as you can tell the irrelevant, and you expand if it's necessary of the one that is required. Now, only at that point do you go to three, and that is structure. Now you have a list of topics that you know are relevant, essential, cut out, you know, the other stuff. Now, I'm not saying you need to have, you know, a beginning, a middle, an end at this point. But you have to have some idea of your overall development. Some idea about, you have like five fruit, a stupid example on the table. Some idea, well, I'm going to start with apples. And I want a climax of pineapples, and apples leads logically to pears. Something like that. If three or four, whatever, you have an idea how one category goes to another. Now, as you're working it, you may find, oh, apples really divided into two, and the other half belongs to pears or whatever. But you can't get there until you take the topics you have and get some order and structure. Now, at this point, you do not write a rough draft, even though you have the topics and an idea of the order. You may think, well, the obvious thing is to start writing a rough draft. Now, there's one important thing you have to do. As well as you can, this is four. You have to estimate the length of what this will turn out. If you use these topics in this order, what kind of length is involved? Now, you may not be able to do it at all, exactly. But before you write, you have to find out, is this going to be way too long? Maybe you get a really nice progression, but you only have room for apples and oranges, and you've got the whole vineyard in there. You have to decide, what are you going to throw out simply on ground? And step two, you throw it on grounds of relevance. And step four, you throw out on grounds of length, size, amount. Now, that is also important, although not as commonly. Make sure it's not too short. If your outline is apples, core, and stem, that's it. And you're going to talk for 20 minutes to apple growers, that's it, you're dead. So if it's too short, before you write, go back. You may have to add something between one topic and the other. You have to expand one topic. But find that out before you do a draft. Now, my problem has always been that my outlines, lectures, whatever, are too long. But too short can be really traumatizing. I had one horrific experience lecturing when Ayn Rand was in the audience. And I was lecturing on her book, Objectivist Epistemology. And it was some hotel, there were hundreds of people. And I thought I had timed it out, well. And part one is supposed to be, what was it? I think it was an hour and a half with a 10-minute break. So I got through, I think the first 45 minutes. I'm into the second half, well into the second half. I have another 45 minutes. What to do? So I went to the men's room. And I tried to disappear, but the final act was, you just can't stay there forever. So I came back. I actually told her, I've run out. I'm not running out. This never happened to me before. What should I do? She said, well, just discuss so-and-so, which is a topic I didn't understand. Anyway, I blundered through and had a longer question paper. Ever since then, without exception, I prepare too much. So if worse comes to worse, there's something to fall back on. So usually you're not worried about being too short, but it can happen. Now, next, I would go to 5, write in the rough draft. And here again, before you write any further, look at it and make sure you haven't really changed the length estimate. In writing the rough draft, your mind gives you more and follows the structure of your writing, and suddenly you look it over. This is twice the length of what I started to do. Then don't edit, because if you start editing, you're wasting a tremendous amount of time perfecting this and that and the other, and half of it has to go anyway. So go back and time it, estimate its length. Only at that point, you pick the relevant topics, you organize them, they're the right amount, you've got a draft. Only then do you consider your wording. Doesn't matter what your wording is up to now. You're trying to get your thought in a sentence, in the form of sentences, and later you turn it into English. A rough draft, if you can't do it more sharply, do it roughly. Do it roughly. I know people who are writing, a rough draft, and they're completely stumped for what goes in this spot. So they just draw a circle and continue after on the other side. And then the next day, they figure out, what was the logic. Or you put the wrong word in, I've done that, and you put an X through it, a line through it, and you keep going. But you don't take time to say, what? You want to keep the momentum going. Now then, when you get to edit, you write down to looking at the specific words. You read it for all the criteria we talked about. Is it clear? Is it logical? Is it, all the rest of the things? And the way I do it, when I get the overall view that it's clear, so I go over every word. Not in the sense of, is this right? Is this that right? But in the sense that I read it slowly in the third person and stop if anything jumps out at me as puzzling or as inaccurate or as boring. Not that I start with the doubt, but I just read to see. And sometimes, if it really is important, I'll have to go through that process 4 or 5 times, because each time I go around, I find a lot of things that I can improve, but it depends how important it is. If you're sending a telegram to your father asking for money, your wording is not too essential, but if you're writing a philosophical hypothesis at the end of your life, then you want to be more accurate. So And then, again, I say at the end, what is the actual final limit? Because if it ends up way too long or way too short, it doesn't make any difference if it's beautiful and clear, etc. They won't publish it. They won't listen to it. It's a waste of time. All right. I don't know if this has helped you. Those are the steps that I go through. I stress the rough draft is rough. A lot of beginning writers, especially objectivists, think, well, I can't write junk. You know, I have to be rational, etc., etc., etc. Do you remember Rourke in the Fountainhead? He said, this is how good his work was. He said, you should see the stuff that I throw in the wastebasket. And that, you have to be prepared to do that. The only problem today is that it's on your hard drive. So if you die, people can exhume it and say, oh my God, look at what he wrote there. By my ideas when you're not here to help it. Now, I'm going to illustrate just step one because, you know, each would take a long, long time. Step one would be helpful to work it out. And I picked the movie E.T. I didn't tell you in advance to see it because I had no idea that her paper was going to be so, good. I know some of you have seen it, but some of you haven't. I'm going to try to make what I say self-contained, but it amounts to an alien from outer space, extraterrestrial E.T., visits, comes to a home of ordinary Americans, of which is a boy, and the two get along very well, but their friendship can't last because the E.T. has to go home. That's basically, they get the idea, but it's all in how they do it. Now, how do you start? You want a laundry list of the type of things that strike you as of interest in that topic. You say, we want a review of E.T. What type of thing would you want to get it all down? The purpose of a laundry list is only vacuum cleaning. In other words, you're taking a vacuum to your subconscious. You're telling the subconscious everything in there relevant to that story, I want out. I don't care how I formulate it, how it relates to anything else. I want it all on the table, like every piece of the jigsaw puzzle, and maybe a jigsaw puzzle and a half. And then I'm going to work with it. So how do you do that? You can, start on the left-hand side of the subconscious and move right. How do you bring it out? Now, a bad method is the rationalist method. Namely, well, I don't know where to start, but E.T. is art. It's literary art. And Ayn Rand says that theme is really crucial to literary art. So I'm going to start with what I think about the theme. But I don't really know what I think about the theme. I'm not sure. So, let's say Ayn Rand thought plot was really important, but plot is purposefully connected events. Now, which events are purposeful? If you do it like that, as some objectivists would, you may as well quit. That's rationalism and hopeless. The way you do it, and may surprise some of you, just let it come. That's all. And you just say, E.T., you know, like a Freudian association, Bacon, St. Age, etc. E.T., what comes to your mind? Now, I actually did this for this class. And the first thing that came to my mind, believe it or not, this is not what I would expect, is a dog near the very end of that movie. Just before it ends, the E.T. and the little boy, what's his name?
Elliot,
yeah, are saying goodbye. And, because E.T. has to go back to his planet, but they're so close that, you can't believe that this is going to happen. And Spielberg, this is a really brilliant touch, he has a little dog trot near them, turn around and run away. Because he gathered, E.T. is alien, he doesn't want anything to do with that. And that suddenly brought back to us the dual nature of what they like about each other and why it's impossible. That little dog changed that scene from being, pointless, why are they leaving, which is what you would feel, to, okay, I see it. And that is, to me, I when I touched him, I said, oh, God, is he smart. Now, he's done many horrible things, but that's what I call purposeful direction. It's not in the script, it's not the actor, it's the director saying, I want a certain feeling, mood, whatever it is. And I'm doing something without words to get there. Completely purposeful. I'll tell you one story in this connection that Ayn Rand told me. She loved Fritz Lang, the old German director from way long ago. And she told me this story that someone in one early silent movie said to him, it was forest scenes, Germanic legend. Your trees were so great. Who, where did you find it? Where is this place? And he said, I don't take trees the way they are. The tree has to look the way I want. Each of these are built. And he said, and his line was, nothing in my movies is accidental. If it's a forest, the fact that the leaf is there doesn't matter. Where is it supposed to be? And that's, in that sense, he, Spielberg, did that. There are so many touches that can make a scene great by no words. Ayn Rand used a wordless, single movement in Rourke's, in many places, but in Rourke's speech, and in his trial, and at the end, Percival rises and faces the court, and at the back of the room, Gail Wynand stands up, which is a really brilliant touch, because he's saying, in effect, I'm guilty, I'm the one that's on trial. So that's why I'm so aware of that, because she used to talk about it. So now, I shouldn't talk this length on every item here, but let's say we've got purposeful use of visuals. We want a category that could belong to. We start a page, and that goes, maybe there'll be nothing else on it, but maybe there will. Now, what would be a good name for that category? Just for what we've said so far, I just call it direction. That's it. I don't want to call it purposeful or God. I don't want to be that specific. I want a category, that I know could be relevant, but that would include this and other. Okay, now go. When I thought of the dog, this is by association. The next thing that occurred to me, that whole scene was very moving. I was in tears. It had a tremendous emotional effect on me. And then I thought, well, that's pretty important in a movie review. So I better make that a point, or at least include that. So I want to include that to be sure I don't forget it. Even that little thing as a separate. See, under one heading, you might have 40 paragraphs, and then the other one line, but you don't want to drop it. What would be a good name for being very, very moved at the end? You got to make these up creatively. I call it ending. And anything else that pertains to the ending goes under that. Now, then the next thought was, well, why was I in tears? Well, because they were separated, they were isolated, they were thrown back to being alone. Well, why? How did that happen? Then I started to think about their relationship and how I go back to, well, I'm crying because they're alone. Well, at one point then they were alone and they got together. How did that happen? And then I remember, step by step by step, they get closer and closer, and one of the things that brings them together is when Elliot starts to look at E.T. as a victim, and he is the champion of E.T. when they get closer. I'm remembering all this once I get into what's involved here, and I think that here's another excellent brief touch by, Spielberg. Here is E.T. and Elliot. Their unity develops with increasing specificity, each making the next step possible. They fall asleep together. Well, first he's afraid of him, but they fall asleep together. Then the alien gets drunk, and he gets drunk in class. And then they do the brain waves, and they can't tell which is which. So he's telling us one step at a time how they are coming together, and in the process, we have this horrible touch, eloquent touch, of what Elliot sees in terms of what's tearing him apart. You remember the little thing about the blood-curdling teacher in the biology class who's explaining to his students, and this is just presented straight, that he's got a live frog in front of him, that he can dissect him while his heart is still beating and alive. And Man thinks that's fine, you know, and the kids will get to see it. But Elliot is horrified. I give him an idea of what the man's attitude is toward life. And of course, he already has ideas about how bad other people are toward life. So now I got a whole bunch of stuff here. Where would this belong? The step-by-step development, in effect, to mutual love, and, well, he's including his desire. The map goes all the way through to the end where he says, I'll always be inside you. So what would you call that? These two people have this relation, and this, and logically leads to this. That's the story. And then they have to be separated. Well, excuse me. Oh, for God's sake. I just said the word. That's the story. So at that point, you would put story. And you have the bare bones. All you have to put down here is purposeful development from sleeping together to love and separation. Or as much as you want. Now, next question. You see, these questions come to me partly by my interest, but partly one of them that I put down raises another question. They're alone at the end. I was so sad. Why are they alone? Well, is it just one's another planet? No, it's not that. Because if that were it, he would land and then he couldn't breathe and take off. But the whole thing was what? There was an enemy, an earthly enemy, all the way through trying to capture him and do to him what the teacher did to the frog. And who was the enemy? The faceless adults, military or whatever they were. You never saw them. They had no specific identity. But the conflict was the faceless adults versus valuing children capable of love and value, whereas the faceless adults wanted only to destroy. Now, we didn't mention that in the story, so where would you put this? Where is the main point in describing faceless adults against the two kids? Yes, put down conflict. That's just what that is. That's the conflict of the movie. The conflict is not. Elliot is ambivalent. You can't have a decent story without a conflict. Now, I'm only on page one out of three pages. Now, next. Now I'm thinking, well, they're together basically against the whole world. Why are they together? What is common? Well, I said they have intelligence, but does the story give us anything that we understand why they have this affinity? And certainly, a good part of it is that each of them is apart from their social environment. Elliot is a misfit, and E.T. is in another world. So Elliot doesn't fit into his world, and E.T. doesn't fit into this world. Each of them is misunderstood, and feels misunderstood. But they're not frightened or cowed by that. They're much more intense than all the other people. They are strong, they have passion, but they're helpless, alienated, they don't know. So where would you put that? The similarities between Elliot and E.T. that is the bond making them closer and closer to that topic. What would you call it?
Characterization,
definitely. That's crucial. Now, I'm writing a short review. You know, you can just jump over, you know. They're both, you know, strong people, misunderstood, or whatever, however you want to do it. But you have to know yourself that that's what's going on. So you won't implicitly treat it as just accidental, you know, or that they have weakness in common, whatever. All right. Now, I see another point here. I see that they each are alienated from the respective world. Well, we know that the faceless adults are against it. We've already said that, and that's the conflict. But now, for the first time, a question comes to me. Why are they faceless? Why didn't he let us see, you know, maybe some twisted or gnarled or vicious sneers or whatever? It's completely, all you see is menacing, flashing lights. This is very purposeful. Because if they shot adults in a regular manner, then right away they would have to raise They have personalities, they have motives. Is there something you could say for their side? Maybe we should ask to talk to them, have negotiation, etc. But this now is, these are robotic destruction of the innocent. That's it. There's nobody there that you can identify. So it's a clear-cut good versus evil. There's no mitigation. Now, where would you put that? If you're going to include that why the adults are faced, I'll put that under characterization, because you're telling us what kind of person the adult, the characterization tells you what the person is, what the entity is, and the story tells you what it does. And here we're talking about what they are, that they're robots. Now, actually, what occurred to me, it really did just occur to me, but I've seen the movie and lectured on it, so it's not just, I kept thinking, these two innocent children against the robot, and they're so much together. I think at some point I thought, they're really close friends at this point. I just, no, they're not close friends, because they are presented that it's the same soul, and each is irreplaceable to the other. They'll miss the other as long as they live. So they actually fell in love. And I think that would be very important. It's like Romeo and Juliet, a tragic love story. But the two here are metaphysically torn apart because they literally can't live in each other's world. Now, you might say that if Romeo and Juliet didn't have such wicked families, it could have worked out. But here, it's inherently hopeless. So what we're getting here really is tragic love in the nature of reality. Tragic love in a hostile universe. Now, I had a student once who told me, the meaning of this movie is the importance of friendship. And no, my answer is the meaning of this movie is the hopelessness of love. The fragility and hopelessness of them. Now, under what title would you put that? Theme, yeah. And here, it comes right out. You know, the story and the characterizations. Now I stop and think, nothing came to me at this point. Have I covered everything? Now, Charlie, what could you say about, you know, professional movie making? Well, I said something about direction. I don't know anything about cinematography. Or make up or all that. I don't even know anything about acting. Or if I do, all I can say is I like that, and certainly not relevant to what I want to say in this movie. So I just put down action. Should I? Question mark. I put that on another page called maybe. If I can't think of anything, then I'll throw it out. But here's the first shot of a possibility. Now I'm thinking. I've covered a plot or the story. I mentioned the theme. Characterization, I've given the characterization of the two kids and the adult, but I haven't given the difference between the two, and I think that's crucial. I haven't really gone into what is E.T. other than that he comes from another planet. So what I've said so far, he could just as well be two boys that he's from, you know, from an orphanage. But I have to go into the character of E.T., what is he? And then once I did that, I think, my God, that's basically the whole movie, is his character. So, you know, if I'd forgotten that, I'd think, oh my God, if I went in the press. But this way, you go back over it and say, have I covered everything in this, everything? Well, I forgot the main character. So then, now this is what I think is another brilliant thing in this movie. E.T. is a lovable child monster. A unique thing in the movie. He's, on the one hand, totally alien, obviously inhuman, but he has two central features that make it possible for us to feel that he's like us, essentially, and to sympathize with him. He has big eyes and long, sensitive fingers. In other words, perception and action, as against having, you know, paws or claws. He is a monster, but he's eager to learn, he's gentle, he likes to play dress-up, and they even very cleverly gave him a mobile neck, where his neck could go all the way down or all the way up. But the idea, when he came at the beginning, he kept his neck all the way down so that they didn't feel threatened. And then only when they felt confident, they moved. This was such a purposeful movement. So we get perfectly the blend of his alien nature and his human participation or feeling. Now, I think one of the smartest lines in this movie was, I thought at the time I saw it before I thought about it, was this. A typical movie, you know, when somebody lost monster wants to get to him back, would say, I want to get out of here. I need to see home again, whatever. Let me go. And here it was so clever. He kept saying, with a plaintive feeling, E.T. phone home. And so that was, he was torn. He wanted to contact, you know, he was drawn to, but he didn't want to leave here. He wanted to stay here. That was so, so clever. If the person who wrote that could write a script for Atlas Shrugged, or could have, it would be so wonderful. But I'm sure if Steven Spielberg and anyone who works for him would denounce Atlas. But you can't take away from him that some of his movies are just, I was going to say, out of this world. Okay, now, I've done everything I can think of in terms of a movie review. Is there any other category relevant, consider, we're not going to discuss all the technical aspects of movie review, everything I can think of theme, characters, story, what else would I want to say in a review? And something occurred to me, well, I've been so positive all the way through. Is there things I don't like about this movie that I would want to talk about? So then the next category I called criticism. Well, I shouldn't. But it came out and I called it criticism. And this is some obvious things. That, for instance, that there's contradictions. That adults can't see him, but the doctors can see him. There's some rough edges like that. And I started to think, well, you know, we could just take that as symbolic, but, you know, treat it some other way. Then it raised in my mind, it's not really a movie that you take on that level. It's really supposed to be like a fairy tale or a fable. And then I put together, well, the adults can't see E.T., only children can see him. So obviously, if you're pure of heart, as against if you're in the good, you're tuned into that. It's like a religious person says, you're aware of God, but the ordinary person on the street is not. And he even refers to Peter Pan, which, you know, that Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie. At one point, he says, clap if you see the fairies, and the little kids all clap. And that's the idea here, that they're not literally fairies. There's a real-life meaning, but I'm giving it on the level of it, so I take back, I cross out criticism. Now I'll leave that, I'll go over another page, because that's not a criticism. That is what? What is that? What category does it come in if I say, it's a fable, not a realist? I put that under genre, category of movie. That may be something I want to say, and not, or at least something I want to know, so I don't present it as though it's all realistic. I'm going to try for another criticism. Now, here's one of the criticism I had. It didn't spoil it for me, but I couldn't avoid knowing it. And that was, he put those two there as a tragic separation. He underscores the hopelessness with the dog, and at the same time, and I'm sure because of the financial backers, he wants a happy ending. So he throws on that, you know, the bicycles riding in the sky and the soaring music and the rainbow. And he has ETC, oh, don't be upset. I'll always be with you. And so, you know, people can say, hope, he hopes, they hope. The box office people hope, you know, the people will go and say, oh, it's uplifting. Well, and that's ridiculous. It doesn't fit into that at all. I mean, imagine it would be like Romeo and Juliet, but Juliet alone dies and Romeo doesn't, and the end is swelling music and the consolation is, it's okay, you'll always remember her. I mean, it's ridiculous, totally ridiculous. But, you know, I'm sure they were told that we won't release it if you don't have a happy ending. But that, to me, is a criticism. Whether I put it in review is a different question. And the only other criticism I really could think of is, philosophic disagreement. I know I'm not going to play with you, just to cover. The idea that when you grow up, you lose your values, your morality, your everything, you become ruthless thugs. So, that's quite a philosophic disagreement.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.